Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Got gas? Hawaii Gas is proposing to hike its rates. We take a closer look. It would be the first hike in 6 years. Made in Hawaii, how a new center in Waihewa can help budding entrepreneurs get a head start from developing new products to packaging and distribution. One piece of the agricultural puzzle. We remember Famous Amos. Did you know he was 12 when he ate his first cookie? We pay tribute to Wally Amos and his cookies, sharing the love. And it is a true story. 81 hours stuck in a New York elevator, now made into an opera. How wacky is that? It is Wednesday, October 16th. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii Gas got its start in the islands 120 years ago as the Honolulu Gas Company. These days, it handles everything from natural synthetic gas to liquefied natural gas to hydrogen. And it just filed a request with the Public Utilities Commission for a rate hike. It's first since 2018. Here to talk about that is HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so are we talking, rate hikes for both residential and commercial customers?
Yes, that is correct. So Hawaii Gas wants to raise its revenues by about $24 million, and it's saying that in order to do that, it needs to raise rates on customers by almost 18%. And exactly how those rates impact customers depends on a lot of factors, where you live, how much gas you use, as well as whether or not you're a residential customer or a commercial customer. And the company is having a series of meetings in order to kind of walk through what all these rate increases mean in detail. A little bit more on that, but just to give folks some interaction or some explanation of how they might interact with Hawaii Gas in their homes. Here in Hawaii, because we don't use gas to heat homes, we don't use as much natural gas, but you may have it in your house for cooking or water heating or perhaps drying clothes or even certain forms of lighting. And 90% of Hawaii Gas utility customers are residential. So this is going to affect a significant number of people if it goes through.
And so when do they want this hike to kick in?
Well, it's not a done deal yet. And so whenever a utility in the islands, be it an electric utility or in this case our gas utility, wants to increase its rates, it first has to submit a request to the Public Utilities Commission, which then has to approve it. And the commission, as I mentioned earlier, is required by law to have public hearings for all the community members who are affected. And those are taking place now. So this week on Maui on the 17th, there's going to be a meeting in person at 5:30 p.m. at Kihei Elementary School. Next week on Oahu, there will be a meeting on October 25th. That's in person at the commission's Oahu office. You can also tune into that online. There'll be two meetings next week as well on Hawaii Island, one in Kona, one in Hilo. And in that second meeting for Hawaii Island, folks from Kauai are also encouraged to tune in remotely. We have information on all of that at hawaiipublicradio.org. And at these meetings, Hawaii Gas is there, as well as the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of the Consumer Advocate. And this is the opportunity for the public to weigh in on how they feel about the rate increase. And the commission will factor that testimony into its decision-making on whether or not to approve this rate increase. And they're also providing really good information at these meetings about what this means for customers. So although customers across the board would see increases, they aren't going to be exactly the same as we discussed earlier. But Hawaii Gas can answer questions that are specific to different types of customers and different communities in these meetings. So for instance, yesterday, this is what Hawaii Gas VP Nathan Nelson said in a public hearing that was geared towards Lanai residents.
For residential customers on Lanai, I know that there's been a number of numbers that have been published in the paper and otherwise, but I wanted to give you a sense from a bill impact perspective, if approved, what it would mean for you. Because the utility system that serves you is very small, you're susceptible to really large rate increases if relatively small changes are made to your utility system. And to lessen that impact, we're proposing to harmonize rates across all neighbor islands. And what this means for you on Lanai, that if the proposed rates are approved, average residential customers whose average consumption is about 13.7 therms a month would see their bill increase from $66 at existing rates to about $72. And that's an increase of about $6 per month.
$6 doesn't seem like a whole lot, but I guess it's going to vary then from island to island.
It is going to vary to island for island, and I want to clarify one thing that Nathan Nelson meant in that meeting when he talks about harmonizing rates between neighbor islands. That means that there's basically going to be two buckets of rates for residential customers, all who is going to be in one bucket, and the neighbor islands are going to be in another bucket. And that's because, as he discussed in that meeting, right, some communities on neighbor islands like Lanai'i and Molokai'i have really small pools of customer bases. So if you were trying to raise rates there, they could feel very dramatic. And the neighbor islands have more shared challenges, like getting gas to different facilities and to different customers across broader topographies.
And so it's really important for people to attend these meetings so they know exactly how much their bill might be raised by.
Exactly. And also to provide public feedback that will be considered by the Public Utilities Commission. There's already been meetings for the Kauai community, Molokai'i, and Lanai'i. I understand that the meeting for Molokai'i was fairly lively, but when I went to the meeting for Lanai'i yesterday, it concluded after 15 minutes with no public testimony. And this is not necessarily an opportunity that folks should pass up if they do feel strongly about this rate increase. So the Public Utilities Commission is clear that even though these meetings are geared towards particular communities, if one for your community has already passed, you can attend any of the meetings. And we have that information, again, available at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Okay, and they can still submit testimony. Yeah, all right. Well, yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote talking to us about the proposed gas rate hike now before the Public Utilities Commission. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Join HPR for an in-person celebration of storytelling and music. Save the date to hear from Kate Tellers of The Moth Radio Hour and Boots Lupe Nui of Kohala Mountain Music Project. This event is on Saturday, October 26th from 12:30 p.m. at HPR's Atherton Studio in Honolulu. Seating is limited. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
You know, when you hear hyperbaric chamber, you might think of divers with the bends. But in the food world, a hyperbaric chamber spelled with an H-I becomes a way to extend the life of food products. Ulu hummus, for example, it might have a shelf life of about a week, but treated under high pressure, it can then be sold for export. You might think the possibilities. Well, this Friday, the Waihewa Product Development Center will debut a webinar to share what this hyperbaric machine can do for a small business. It's equipment that's rare in Hawaii. We recently took a tour of the new facility, which opened its doors 6 months ago. It operates under the umbrella of Leeward Community College. We're told some 60 people have gone through classes since last year. 15 were able to showcase their products in the Made in Hawaii Food and Product Show. Some are already on shelves in Foodland and ABC stores. LCC Chancellor Carlos Penaloza and State Senator Donovan Dela Cruz explain how someone with an idea for a product can cut through the development red tape and get it to market. To set the stage, it is a very big facility built on land under control of the Agriculture Development Corporation. There are wet kitchens and dry kitchens, and it's stocked with state-of-the-art equipment areas for bottling and labeling with commercial fryers and ovens. There's even a machine that can peel 80 pounds of potatoes in 3 minutes. Penaloza starts us off.
This facility only opened this last April. We started delivering some instruction last year to bring in existing entrepreneurs. And so the definition of a student for us is really broad. Any and all of you could be my students. An existing business could be one of our students. Because they have a local product and they want to bring their cost point down, they want to scale up, they want to beautify their packaging, whatever it is, we help them through that process. So far, we've completed 4 cohorts. 60 small businesses have come through. As a cornerstone to this all is really trying to get local entrepreneurs to scale and support our local economy. 15 of the participants were at Made in Hawaii, the convention. And so we are having that kind of momentum. This facility is an ADC, is on ADC land. We work really well with DBED and other state agencies to support these businesses. Our mission is education. And so again, education is trying to get a high school student to know that this is a viable pathway. But it's also taking an entrepreneur and getting them to that next level.
Most guys, if they're gonna start a business and they're organic, it takes forever. Yes. You're learning, you're fumbling on yourself. You might not have the capital. This helps you kind of figure out packaging, right, accounting, marketing, social media, Department of Health requirements, you know, potential for export with DBED. So right, this really is going to help entrepreneurs learn it faster so we can scale them up.
The model that we have is actually a 12-week course. In that 12-week course, we cover all of the aspects of building a business in this space. And then our faculty and subject matter experts will work with individual participants on where their needs are. You could have a business that's already in the ABC stores and so they're looking for the next level.
Yeah.
Like you could have someone that you're selling out of the trunk of their car.
Yeah.
And so because everyone's in a different place, we don't want to put someone through a 4-year program. The 12 weeks and then through consulting and hands-on engagement will get them to the next phase.
Now, and they're working with high schools already for a high school entrepreneurship program.
Right.
So they can already learn product development and entrepreneurship.
One of the values that came through all of this, the vision, which is broad, and of course Senator Dela Cruz has been spearheading a lot of it, is rescuing our farmers. A lot of the stuff that's grown in the farms is disposed, or they can't sell it, they can't offload it because there's off-grades. And so that just means it may be a little ugly. Still edible, tastes the same, but just not the right stuff that you would put into a supermarket. And so as a result of that, we are engaging with those farmers and entrepreneurs and connecting the dots. Hey, you have some tomatoes that are a little ugly. Let's find something to do with those ugly tomatoes.
Yeah.
And we have actually classes happening right now where we start the students with those off-grades. Here's the off-grade. Here's the faculty, let's engage in new product development with these. And so generating those ideas and then taking them to the next level. When we were engaging with different organizations internationally and in the States for envisioning how all of this would happen, the main question we asked is, what would you have done differently? Where do you see the biggest impact happening? And so we created what is really the best one that we've ever seen so far. And we've been, again, places like New Zealand, Japan, we've been to Oregon State, we've gone to a lot of different places,
Nebraska,
where they have
Arkansas,
Nebraska, and even Cornell. And our facility is really the best one, biggest, best equipped, and it has equipment that is unique to the state of Hawaii. So imagine the barriers our entrepreneurs face, right? And so they're cooking out of their kitchen. To scale up, they can't scale out of their kitchens. they need the next space, right? And so we are that next space for them, but then they'll need other areas. And so that's where we're looking at the Whitmore Food Hub as the next space for entrepreneurs to continue engaging in that.
Well, one other point is that in New Zealand, you're already an entrepreneur and you're going to their facility. In the other, across the US, it's mainly a 4-year campus. So it's like their College of Tropical Ag. This is the only one at a community college,
right,
that's working with high school pipelines, that's taking any kind of, you can be a student, you can be an existing business, versus other places, you know, it's gonna be at their College of Agriculture,
right,
or their type of facility. So the barriers of entry are much higher than this one. You know, part of our vision when we all worked on this was, you take a small town like Hawi, sugar closed, if you can get 3 or 4 entrepreneurs to scale up to the same size as Big Island Candies, that whole town can get revitalized with jobs. Hamakua Coast, Wahewa, Waialua. You start entrepreneurship, local entrepreneurship, helping local ag, and then now you have manufacturing and export.
And we are supporting, again, with the help of DBED, our students with their exposure. We've had market pop-ups at Pearl Ridge Mall. We are gonna be having some right here in Wahewa. Again, made in Hawaii, and looking at some fancy food shows and events where these products can really get to that next phase of exposure.
And then DBED is gonna start to work with the community college on specific seminars, how to do business in Japan, what you're gonna need, what kind of regulation, channels of distribution, how to deal with the Japanese retailer, how to understand their palate. That's one, you know, they could go from one country to the other, Taiwan, to help our students understand how to do business internationally.
That's right.
That was a snapshot of the Wahewa Product Development Center that was built as part of Phase 1. The larger vision is to help develop Central Oahu into an agricultural hub and boost our food production and food security. The Office of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism is dovetailing its effort to increase exports, helping to grow our small businesses to get into the Costcos around the world and help diversify Hawaii's economy. Phase 2 of that vision, a vision that Senator Dela Cruz has, includes a facility in Whitmore Village to expand a warehouse space for refrigerated and dry goods. We'll have links to the center and the upcoming webinar on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. R&B and soul singer-songwriter Life Jennings performs songs such as Must Be Nice in 2 sets nightly. Opening this Friday, tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
In Morocco, climate change is making the drought worse, so the country needs new ways to maintain its water supply. One solution, tap into seawater.
Now we are in this site of desalination station because we think that in Morocco, this is the solution.
What it takes to climate-proof Morocco's waterways, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, olehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omau, ukaholabe, ohawaii.
We are digging into the TV archives, and we're inspired by some vintage footage of a 1970s sitcom that filmed on location at a Diamond Head estate in Kahala. It aired for 2 seasons from 1972 through 1974 on NBC. The storyline followed pediatricians Dr. Sean Jameson and his daughter Anne, who ran a free children's clinic. In the debut season, the show was listed in the TV guide as The Little People. Then in the fall of 1973, the show was renamed The Brian Keith Show. It aired on Friday nights right after Sanford and Son. For today's Backyard Quiz, we want to know the name of the Hawaii actor who played a regular supporting cast member. She was a pretty friendly nurse and receptionist who kept the office in running order.
Dr. Jamie, I think we need some new magazines in the waiting room. The coupons have all been torn out and the children have written naughty words around the edges. Did you see what it said about Lisa Watanabe?
Yes. Get some new magazines.
I recognize this voice. Well, tell us her name and win a tote bag if you're the first one to get it right. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
The life of the late Wally Amos, the creator of the famous Amos cookie brand, will be celebrated on Oahu this weekend. Amos lived in Hawaii from 1977 to 2018 and passed away at his home in Honolulu this past August. Jeff McIntyre is a filmmaker who documented Amos's success, his failures, and attempts to recapture that success in the film The Great Cookie Comeback.
I'd go to meetings and I would take cookies to meetings with me. So I use cookies as my calling card, literally. I developed a nice reputation in Hollywood for making chocolate chip cookies that really tasted great. Chocolate chip cookies was my calling. There's a shelf somewhere in this cosmic world that has what each of you, each of us, meant to do, be. And the shelf of chocolate chip cookies had my name on it.
Yes, and I've eaten many of those cookies. The Conversation's Russell Subiono talked with McIntyre this morning about the life and legacy of Famous Amos.
The stage is set in Tallahassee, Florida. It's 1936, and that birth kind of changed the trajectory of the world. Wally Amos is born. And keep in mind, this is right on the heels of the Great Depression. He's deep in the segregated South. I mean, there's not a lot of examples for success and entrepreneurship in his immediate world. So that's kind of the framework that Wally is born into. And he spends, you know, the next 12 years living in kind of a dysfunctional home, his parents fighting all the time until they decide to get divorced. So Wally's 12 years old, and his mom puts him on a train bound for New York City to go live with his Aunt Della for a while. And this is a really pivotal moment, because up until that point, 12 years of Wally's young life, he's never tasted a chocolate chip cookie, because his mom would make cakes and pies. But his Aunt Della, she loved to bake chocolate chip cookies. And the moment he sunk his teeth into that chocolate chip cookie in her little kitchen in New York, I don't know he realized it at the time, but that would set him off on his trajectory to become the Cookie King.
And you mentioned that he dropped out of high school as well. And I think I read somewhere that he first came to Hawaii when he was in the military. How much do you know about that part of his life?
So days away from Wally's 17th birthday, he begs his mom to let him drop out of high school. I mean, yeah, what a nutty request. How many kids have tried that and actually succeeded? Well, that was another one of Wally's, you know, successful marketing moves. Being, you know, kind of a marketing expert, he found a way to sell his mom on allowing him to drop out of high school to join the Air Force. So once he completes basic training on the mainland, then he endures a long, bumpy, you know, boat ride to Hawaii. And that's where he's stationed, at Hickam Air Force Base. That really gives him that initial taste of the Aloha spirit, which he's never able to shake from his soul. And I mean, from that moment on, I think that just planted the seed. He had to find a way to get back to Hawaii because it meant so much to him. And just that Aloha spirit was so invigorating and nourishing that he wanted to find a way to bake that into his products.
I grew up on the Big Island, and I remember seeing him around the Big Island. In fact, I grew up thinking that he was from the Big Island. I just remember him being so charismatic and so engaging and just a super cool guy. There was something about Hawaii that he really loved.
And that's where it all started. And it's so funny you bring that up, Russell, because so many people say that. So many people assume that he was kind of born and raised there. He just embodies that spirit. And whether you casually meet him on the street or you do business with him, he instantly becomes a friend. He just had that friendly, welcoming, loving spirit that he shared with everybody.
What I learned from your documentary, which I hadn't known before, obviously he was a great showman, a great salesman, but I didn't realize that he had become a talent agent in California well before he started selling cookies. And the connections he made in that job that kind of helped launch his first business selling cookies, right?
Definitely. Wally has lived a life of firsts. And one of those firsts was being one of the first African-American talent agents. He was one of the first black talent agents at William Morris, the largest, you know, talent agency in the world at the time in Hollywood, California. And he's credited discovering Simon and Garfunkel. He's worked with Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, Diana Ross. It's just nuts. And when I embarked on the documentary project, I had no idea of Wally's pre-cookie life. So this is just jaw-dropping to learn of his influence in just the music and entertainment world. But Wally was a brilliant marketer. So keep in mind, he doesn't open his first Famous Amos store until 1975. But as a talent agent, 5 years previous to that store opening, he is using cookies as his calling card. Every meeting he shows up at, in his hand is a warm bag of his freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. So around Hollywood, he's just known as the cookie guy. So he kind of, you know, makes this great reputation for himself with, you know, his sweet treat. But it's 1974, and by now, Wally's made a lot of connections. But one, I mean, the biggest, I mean, Quincy Jones, Grammy-winning rock star, record producer, Quincy Jones' secretary, B.J. Gilmore, invites Wally to dinner. And she already knows that Wally is the cookie guy. So at dinner, she says, Wally, why don't you and I open a cookie store? And oh my goodness. At that point, I think all the lights dimmed in the restaurant and a big spotlight, you know, shone on her. And that was that pivotal moment when he said, yes, this is what I was destined for. And he really didn't know if that was going to be a success or not. He was following his heart. And, you know, Wally has a history of letting kind of joy be his guide. And most of the time, it really did pan out. And I'll tell you something that wasn't an easy feat to pull off in 1975. I mean, he didn't have any real money, but what he had were wildly famous connections. So he made some phone calls, and check this out. He got some loans from Helen Reddy, very famous singer back in the day, Artie Mogul, which is the president of United Artists Records, and Marvin Gaye. They all invested some money in the Famous Amos cookie store.
From what I can tell in your documentary and what I've read on the internet, things just soared from there. I saw that he was able to create a whole business and revenue was building, and it seemed like he was the talk of the town.
And you nailed it. And so just for the timeline, so he opens his Famous Amos store in a primo spot on Sunset Boulevard back in March 1975, hits big, he starts expanding. He opens more stores. He gets some deals with department stores to sell his cookies in the stores. The media, of course, falls in love with him. And now he's becoming kind of a pop culture icon. But by his own admission, he was really more into the show than the business. 10 years later, business starts slipping. The losses are mounting, and he needs to, you know, bring in more investors. But the more people he brings in means the less control he has of his company. And between 1985 and 88, Famous Amos chews through four different owners. And it's just really a stressful time. And in 1989, just fed up, Wally walks away.
I know it was especially hard for Wally because I believe he signed away the right to use his name as well, right?
He signs away all his rights to use his God-given name and likeness on any future cookie product. And I really believe that that was a serious roadblock to him ever scoring another big cookie hit. But, you know, in Wally form, as many probably would gather up their baking sheets and walk away, but not Wally. for the next 30 years of his life, he tripled down and hustled even harder to try to kind of regain the throne to the Cookie Kingdom. I think in the process, he started 12 different cookie companies. And when I met up with him around 2014-15, Cookie Kahuna was the latest brand on offer. And that cookie brand really starts growing. There's momentum. I think he's, you know, in Costco's on the islands. He's selling them, of course, as only Wally can, blowing the kazoo and just making people feel good.
And, you know, cookies aside, I know that he was also known for his literacy advocacy. I know he helped thousands of adults learn to read. Did he share with you why that was important to him?
I think just like his cookies, he'd tell you there's a piece of himself in every bite of his cookie, because he really did bake love into those chocolate chip cookies. And I think he treated every venture, everybody, with that spirit, including literacy. That was so important to him. And keep in mind, once again, Wally Amos living a life of first, he was really one of the first quote-unquote celebrity advocates for literacy in America in the 70s. He was doing public service announcements. He was partnering with other organizations to really bring literacy front and center. And that also became such a driving force in his life. And I remember when I was shooting the doc with him, we went to a school and he read to the kids, which he would do whether or not, you know, we had cameras rolling, because that was so important. Because I think he felt when you give the gift of literacy to a child, you're really giving them the keys to the world. You unlock a future that they may not have thought they had. And I really think he cherished those moments. And that kind of became a cornerstone of his life.
I did also want to talk about the event coming up on Sunday, celebrating Wally's life. Can you share the details about that event?
In 2024, the world is in desperate need of more Wallys. Unconditional love, acceptance, inclusion. These aren't just like uplifting words in a memorial service. These were Wally's guiding principles. And that's what we really hope to share at this event on Sunday, the Hawaii Theater. And also really important was it had to be accessible, because that's what Wally would have wanted. And that's why it is a free event. And yes, you get to come out and watch the documentary about Wally's life. There's going to be live music, hula, and just a bunch of, you know, laughs and good times as we share and remember the legacy of Wally Amos.
Jeff McIntyre, thanks so much for remembering Wally Amos with me, man. I really appreciate your time.
Mahalo. And please, everyone, come out. I want to see you at the Hawaii Theater this Sunday. Let's celebrate Wally together.
That was filmmaker Jeff McIntyre talking with HPR's Russell Subiano about the life of Wally Amos, better known to many as the creator of the famous Amos cookie. A celebration of Amos's life will be held, as we heard, at the Hawaii Theater, 2 p.m. this Sunday. It is free and open to the public. We'll have a link to more information on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Maui.
Nearly 200 businesses across the state rely on HPR underwriting to reach engaged listeners like you. Mahalo to Stadia Capital Group, Anti-Snorkel Rentals, and Kona Choral Society. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our underwriters at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, connecting Hawaii with international destinations including Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea. Schedules and reservations at hawaiianairlines.com/international.
Pet or pest? Well, on this week's Mono Minute, we've got the songs, or rather the squawks, of the introduced rose ring parakeet that is courtesy of recordings from the Macaulay Library of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
There are no native parrots or parakeets in Hawaii, but many species have been brought here by people over the years and have escaped into the wild to form breeding populations. Among the most abundant are rose-ringed parakeets. They're emerald green and measure about 16 inches from the tip of their bright red hooked bill to the end of their long pointed tail. Only the males have the black to rose-colored neck ring that gives them their name. Like all birds in the parrot family, they have what's known as zygodactylous feet, where two toes point forward and two toes point back. Rose-ringed parakeets are now considered to be the most widespread parrot in the world. They were first brought to Hawaii in the early 1960s as pets, and have since expanded to over 15,000 individuals, primarily on the islands of Kauai and Oahu. They roost together in large groups in big trees, and may fly many miles to their foraging grounds. The large amounts of defecation below these trees in areas where people live is considered a health hazard. They can also be incredibly noisy when roosting. Perhaps you've heard the loud squawks of these birds when in flight or at their roost. Although highly intelligent and beautiful, they're considered to be severe agricultural pests throughout the world because they consume a huge variety of grains, fruits, and flowers. They're a particular problem for small farmers on Kauai who annually lose a large percentage of their crops to these birds. The Kauai Rose Ring Parakeet Working Group is actively searching for ways to reduce these losses and support these local farmers. Fortunately, these birds are found mostly in human-modified habitats and rarely are seen in our native forests. For this reason, and also because they mainly crush the seeds that they consume, they aren't considered to be effective dispersers of weeds that might compete with our native plant species, at least yet. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Evergreen by Deborah. At evergreenbydeborah.com, learn more about porcelain tile by Royal Mosa, made using recycled water and hydroelectric power to create floor and wall tiles inspired by trends in design and architecture.
Now it's time for the backyard quiz answer. Earlier, we dug up a 1970s sitcom. It was filmed on an estate at the foot of Diamond Head. A lot of local keiki got screen time, as the story was about a pair of father-daughter pediatricians who ran a free children's clinic in Kohala. Here's the soundtrack from the opening credits.
Aloha, doctor.
Hi, Dad.
Little bones and little hearts can sometimes end up broken. Medicine works twice as well when understanding.
Does that ring a bell? It was created by Gary Marshall. It debuted in 1972 and was called The Little People. A year later, it was renamed as The Brian Keith Show. Some episodes were written by Marshall around the time that he was launching ABC's Happy Days. This morning, we asked you who was the local actress who played the sidekick character who kept the chaotic office running smoothly. Nurse Pooney was played by local talent Victoria Young. And we stumped you on this one. No winners today. But that's our quiz. And if you have an idea for one you want to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Being trapped in an elevator for 81 hours is the premise of Hawaii Opera Theater's season opener, Stuck Elevator. At the center of the story is an undocumented Chinese immigrant fearing deportation. So he chooses to wait for rescue instead of hitting the help button. First created over a decade ago by composer Byron Au Yong, the piece ended up forgotten in a drawer. Then Nashville Opera's CEO and artistic director John Humes caught wind of the piece through a mutual friend. The story intrigued him so much that he contacted Ao Yang, and they worked together to stage it for the Nashville Opera. It morphed into a comic rap scrap metal opera. Take a listen to one of the songs, a flashback scene where the main character faces an unexpected situation during a routine delivery. Your typical opera. After last year's successful Nashville run, Humes was invited by HOT to direct Stuck Elevator's Hawaii premiere. He came down to our studio to talk with the conversation's Lillian Song.
Nowadays, there's so much prejudice and so much hate, and the easiest way to hate anyone if you don't know them, if you're able to be convinced they're the other and they're not like you. And so what I found interesting about the piece is once it starts, we get to know Guang. We get to know this man. And he is a man from China. He's here in this country. He was smuggled here to the country to have a better life for himself and his family. We see that he loves his little boy as an 8-year-old boy. He loves his wife. He has a lot of challenges in life. He has to pay the human smuggler back. And so as we watch all this, he becomes very human. And we see that even if you're not Chinese, even if you're not Asian, you see this man. He has the same hopes and dreams we do. He loves his family. He's scared at times of the future. And so what I found interesting is that the character of Guang has no character arc in a dramatic sense. He's trapped in the elevator. And at the end, he is the same. He has lost time working. He hasn't made money. He's been through a terrible ordeal. But as a person, he is the same person. But what's changed is the audience. Because the audience at first sees him as a faceless Asian man. But by the end, we see that he is not really different than us.
Wow. And this is based on a true story. Caught in an elevator, trapped for more than 3 days.
So the real story is this gentleman went to a high-rise in the Bronx. It was around a 37-story high-rise. He made a delivery. It was a Friday afternoon, mid-afternoon, 4 o'clock, and he made a delivery. He got back in the elevator to keep going with his job. The elevator sticks, and then it falls almost 20 stories. And then it sticks there briefly, and then it falls again, and it lodges finally for good on the third floor.
Whoa.
And of course, he's shocked by this, but he's not hurt. And he said, well, somebody, I'm sure, will find me. What he didn't realize, it was a holiday weekend. And so it was a Friday, and everyone left for the holiday. And then, no spoiler alert, but he was finally rescued from the elevator 81 hours later. Mm. So he spent the weekend plus Monday in the elevator. And in the elevator, there was a button to be able to call for help, an emergency button. And he didn't press it because he was an undocumented worker. And he was afraid that if he did, depending on who showed up, they may ask for his papers. He does not have any, and he'd be shipped back to China.
An outcome he was trying to avoid.
Very much. And once you're stuck in an elevator, the things you don't think about is, one, how do I eat? How do I use the restroom? And some of that's dealt with in the show. I do want to make sure people know, though, this is not a one-man show or a two-person elevator and one-man show. There are 5 characters total in the show. There's the one gentleman whose name is Guang, who is the person who's stuck. And there are 4 other characters. As by the score, there are 4 Asian singers and 1 Latino singer. So once Guang is stuck, he's by himself at first in the story. And then he starts thinking back of his life in China and his wife and his little boy. He starts thinking about the restaurant he works in and the horrible female boss he has that threatens to fire him or expose him and call the police on him to keep him in line. Mm-hmm. And so the opera becomes a series of flashbacks and hallucinations and dream sequences. I have two very large high-def video walls that make up the elevator. But during the dream sequences, they become either the Chinese ocean with the moon above with his memories, or it becomes a casino, or it becomes a giant Chinese buffet restaurant he hopes to open one day in Long Island. And there's a lot of comedy in this. It sounds like a very serious piece, and parts of it are. But the thing that struck me and drew me to it is a lot of it's funny. And it's hard to find a lot of funny contemporary operas. And so Byron O'Young, the composer, and Aaron, the librettist, find so much humor in the piece. But at its heart, it is a very serious story. But it's also fun. Mm. It's not one of these grim pieces that, you know, beat you in the head trying to, you know, make you come to its point of view. It's an entertaining show. It just runs the gamut. There are like 18 scenes in the piece that just change your perspective on what's going on.
So through the staging, through the music, just in my mind, I had first envisioned with just one delivery man in the elevator. But through the magic of staging, we're now exploring his mindscape on stage.
Right. The music is such an important part of the piece. The libretto, first of all, is brilliant. Aaron is a wonderful writer. And there is rap music sometimes in this, more 90s rap, I will say. But the music and the orchestra play such an important part in the mood of the piece. The orchestra, there are only four players. Piano, percussion, a lot of percussion, Western and Eastern percussion. And there's a violin and a cello. And what Byron is able to get out of that small group is amazing. The texture and the sound. One of the most interesting instruments is a bicycle wheel with a playing card that's stuck in the spokes. And so at one point during, I think, the song Shame, the percussionist spins the wheel. So you get this in the background. So he's put all kind of really interesting percussions. There's a water gong where you hit the gong and then you lower it in water so it goes bow. There's some crazy interesting sounds in it. There are also a number of sound cues in it. Again, I treat this piece more like a movie. And so the video plays with various sound cues. Guang keeps mentioning Marco, one of his coworkers, keeps everyone up watching Mexican wrestling on TV. And so we have a very large-scale Mexican wrestling scene that happens in the second half. It is very eclectic.
With the masks and everything?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Masks? Yeah, like Santos of the Mexican. Oh, yeah, yeah. But all of it hinges off him watching Mexican wrestling, and that comes into the piece. There is a piece called The Stick Up, and that comes from him talking about being mugged once before. What Byron and Aaron have done with that Stick Up song, which is a fantastic piece, they blended the memory and the trauma of being mugged with the panic over not being able to relieve yourself. It's the weirdest combination. And yes, one character plays Guang's bladder. It's the weirdest moment, but it feels very logical in the piece, mm-hmm. and it's actually kind of funny.
I'm so intrigued. There's a bladder character?
Yeah, there's a bladder character, who, by the way, whose name is Splatter.
Mm. Okay, got to remember that. Splatter the bladder.
Yeah.
And I know it's like your favorite child thing, but what song do you like to sing the most in the car?
I'll tell you my favorite part that I sing, and it's not even necessary. There are words eventually, but it starts. There's a scene with Guang and his nephew as they're coming to America in the belly of a container ship. And it's the second part of the scene. And Byron has written some of the most evocative and beautiful and sorrowful music, but it's beautiful. I can't express enough how much I love that music. And I find myself humming it all the time.
Hum a few bars?
No. No, I am not a singer. I'm
only
a stage director.
Only
in the car.
Okay. All
only
right.
Only in the car. Yeah. It's because this entire show is a little bit of like short attention span opera, because if it's something you don't care for, give it 2 minutes, something new is going to happen. And it's like a roller coaster, because you just hang on and the show just unfolds in front of you, and it's incredibly fast paced.
The music is, it ranges. You've got rap, you've got hip hop, as well as pop elements, but then there's still that opera.
It's like a mixture of Mozart and Puccini mixed with soft 80s rock. And it is very catchy. It's surprisingly melodic. And when a lot of people hear it's a contemporary opera, they're kind of afraid. They're afraid it's going to sound like someone dropped a tray of silverware down a staircase. That is not the case here.
I see. So Nashville audiences have already seen this, but how do you hope Hawaii audiences will receive Stuck Elevator?
Well, let me tell you, Nashville audiences, I didn't know what to expect. It's such a different piece. But Nashville audiences were overwhelmingly positive about it. They received this so well and they loved it. And one thing that I found interesting after we did it in Nashville is so many people came up to me and said, where can I buy a recording of this? Now, you never hear that for contemporary opera. You just don't. But so many people said, is this on Spotify? Where can I hear this again? And I had to say, well, you can't. I mean, I wish we could make a recording of it, because it needs to be heard. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the performance in Nashville too, a good friend of mine who is an older doctor from the Philippines, she came up to me and she was very weepy. And she said, I cannot tell you how much of this type of thing I experienced when I first came to this country. And I went, wow, okay. So I think the Hawaii audience is going to see a lot they can feel and identify with. I think it's an important piece for what it says and the humanity of the piece. And nowadays, we need more humanity, for sure.
Before I let you go, John, is there anything else you wanted to share with us? Anything else you want to say about Stuck Elevator?
I want to say a thank you to Hawaii Opera Theater for being courageous. It's not a traditional Mozart or Puccini, and I love those pieces, but there's so many wonderful contemporary pieces that are written today about us. And so I want to say bravo to them for trusting me with it, but also trusting that this is a piece their audience will really embrace, and I think it will.
Sounds like fun. That was CEO John Humes of Nashville Opera talking with HPR's Lillian Song. Humes is directing Hawaii Opera Theater's season opener, Stuck Elevator. The dramedy rap opera is sung in English, Chinese, and Spanish with English and Mandarin subtitles. Performances are Friday, October 18th, and Sunday, October 20th at the Neil Blaisdell Arena. And the public is invited to take part in both pre-concert and post-show talks.
And see my name, then send me back to China, and Ming will see me wear the same old clothes. She'll cry because she knows, and each tear a mirror repeating my new name, which will be
Well, we're out of time, so we have to go. But tomorrow we prepare to mark the 80th anniversary of the liberation of a French hillside town, and we remember the sacrifice that Hawaii soldiers from the famed 442nd made. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Like podcasts, find the Conversation Podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.